From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Seattle's Fifth Avenue Theater is celebrating the 10th anniversary of the hit musical Hairspray this week. We're going to talk with the Fifth Avenue's artistic director, David Armstrong, about how that musical production changed the future of the theater. Also coming up this hour, writer Colm McCann talks about his new book, Transatlantic, which focuses a bit on the Irish Peace Accords, the Northern Irish Peace Accords of 1995. The second extra legislative session heads into its second week today. Everett Herald political writer Jerry Kornfield's been joining us through all the legislative sessions, and he's with us once again. Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning.
Could this be the week that we get a budget agreement?
I have been so bad at predicting what this legislature is going to do. I'm afraid to say that I think it could be, but these guys, every time I say it might be, they decide to prove me wrong.
Well, you indicated in the email that you had a slight tinge of optimism.
Well, all the pieces seem to be lining up. Last week, I believe what is probably the, if you will, the big breakthrough. I don't want to call it a blink. But the Senate, which is dominated by Republicans, passed a bill late Thursday night to restore or close a loophole in the estate tax that voters approved. And by doing so, they preserved $160 million for the budget process. And that's been an issue. They've been calling that a tax they wouldn't support. Now, by supporting it, that kind of opens the door, I think, to negotiations with the House Democrats in a new way, and the House Democrats can provide something, reach back over, if you will, and make another concession to them. That changed the dialogue. And tomorrow, the new forecast of tax collections will be coming in. It's a report that says, here's what the state's going to collect over the next 2 years. And in March, it said it was up a little bit. The economy was coming around. If tomorrow it says the collections are going to come in a little higher, $50 million, $100 million, somewhere in there, that should ease a little bit of the stress in negotiations, because at that point, I think the House and Senate will have said, okay, we've kind of agreed on how much we want to spend. Now let's just go ahead and figure out how to spend it.
How much money or theoretical money separates the House and Senate, or the Democrats and the Republicans?
Well, it's always hard to look at the numbers and be hard and fast on them, but it does look like the House has come down. They want to raise less in new taxes, and the Senate has come up by accepting some taxes and giving up on some cuts. So it looks like they're in that $300 to $400 million range, and it's really loose and goose, because the House still has some tax bills they want to pass. And the Senate opposes. So I look for the House to pare its list down a little bit and spend less. And then I look for the Senate to agree to at least one more tax measure dealing with telecommunications, and that'll raise their spending level up. And one comes down, the other comes up, at that point they're just, they could be within $100-150 million by the end of the day tomorrow. If there's another piece of information they're going to get, it's called the caseload forecast. Essentially, it's how many people are demanding public services, either because they got locked up in prison, they're going to schools, or they need health care. In March, that report showed a lot fewer people were making such demands. It saved about $300 million on paper from the projected costs. And now it looks, if they get another report like that, I think that pretty much eliminates all their differences in terms of dollars and cents, and they can really get down to a line-by-line discussion.
So that's the budget, but I know that last week when we spoke, the majority caucus in the Senate had put forward these sort of three main policy areas that they felt were most important, and that they weren't, if the House would agree to them, then everything, the dam would break as well. I haven't heard anything about those as yet. One was to eliminate any kind of budget increases based on the growth of state population, except in the area of education. And the other one had to do with principals being able to veto staff members. Have they done any work on education?
Well, they did on education, but they did not deal with that principal, the bill dealing with the principals, or what they call around here mutual consent, where the principals can decide who teaches at their schools and who does not. What they did do, though, is they did about every other piece of the education reform package that the Senate has been pushing. and that's now waiting for action in the House. So I think the principal bill has now been put aside. So has the bill on the spending limits. Senate Majority Leader Rodney Tom implied that they're off the table. And so they're down now to get the education reform policies that they put forth. And I think they still want to get the workers' compensation. And I think what they'll probably find a midway point between what the Senate wants, which is to allow workers starting at age 40 to be able to get a lump sum payout known as a structured settlement. The law today is 55. I think you'll see the House come down, and they'll end up somewhere between age 45 and 50 and call it a day on that bill.
Mm-hmm. What about transportation funding?
Well, that's a great question, because that's been such a priority of the governor and some in the House Democratic Caucus. But if they start making headway on the operating budget, it may move so fast they just can't simply, you know, put forth a transportation package. I think the House Democrats would be under a lot of pressure not to hold that bill hostage. And the Senate Republicans put out a proposal last week that was, you know, quite a bit different, not in how they raise the money. They agree to raise the gas tax, but they don't want to spend it in some areas where the House Democrats do, and, you know, particularly they don't want to put any money into Snohomish County, and that's where Boeing is at. And these days, trying to help Boeing find reasons to stay here is important of a legislature. So there's going to be a lot of fighting over that to get it done.
Speaking of Boeing, we're going to talk about the Paris Air Show at 10 o'clock. So if listeners are curious what's going on with Boeing, you want to stick with us. I read some interesting statistics over the weekend about the first special legislative session. One of the first in history, if not the only one, where they didn't pass a thing.
Yeah, now, I think there's a double-edged sword there. Folks would have liked to see them pass enough bills to get finished and go home. But, hey, when government comes in and doesn't do anything, there's a few people out there saying, you know, thanks for not doing anything to us. So, but, yeah, that was it was unique because they did not get finished. And the only way they were going to get finished is to pass a number of bills and reach agreement on the budget. They didn't reach agreement on the budget, so I think they came to the conclusion late in that first session that there's nothing worth passing.
Huh.
I mean, they're all related to the budgets, and that's where they're going to be. The other bill that's been kind of lingering around is an impaired driving bill that there's a reportedly bipartisan support, but I'm not sure if either the House or the Senate feels it's important enough to push through at this stage. It will be expensive in terms of 30 to 40, maybe $50 million a year short term, and hundreds of millions later to build a whole jail based on what it would do to the state. So I think that one may fall as well to the wayside.
Well, you mentioned expensive. It's not exactly cheap for the taxpayers to keep legislators in Olympia for a second special session.
Yeah, you know, they are entitled to per diem, and I think if folks think about it, if you're a lawmaker from Spokane, you have to come over, you have to stay somewhere, and the per diem is intended to cover some of their costs for room and board. And some lawmakers take it, and some don't. And when you add up all the money spent so far on those who have taken per diem, it's in excess of $75,000 so far, and it's going to go up.
Wow. Well, Jerry, we're having some weird phone issues. Either the NSA is listening in or maybe state lawmakers are. So we're going to let you go and do your job and hope next week when we talk to you, perhaps will be the last time of this legislative series of sessions. So thanks for your time.
Wouldn't that be nice if they'd be done by then?
Jerry Kornfield covers state politics for the Everett Herald. He's been a regular guest on Weekday throughout the ongoing legislative sessions. They started in January, still going strong. June 30th is the deadline for a budget to be passed without some kind of government shutdown. We'll be checking in with Jerry as the legislative session progresses. This is Weekday on KUOW.
It's 9:16. We're going to find out how to handle the summer's heat and festivities in an environmentally friendly way in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
63 degrees in Seattle. Forecast says we're going to reach 72 this afternoon. It's going to be partly sunny today with a chance of showers. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:17. Colin McCann, award-winning author of literary fiction, joins us in about 20 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. You may have fired up your grill yesterday for a Father's Day celebration, or maybe you brought out a gas lawnmower to trim your lawn, or maybe you turned on your sprinklers. Summertime's great, but it's also a season where we use gadgets and power. Is there a way to enjoy our tools and be ecologically aware at the same time? That's a good question for Tom Watson. He writes the Eco-Consumer column for the Seattle Times. He manages King County's Eco-Consumer Public Outreach Program, and he's here to answer your questions about how to balance convenience and the environment this summer. You can email us weekday@kuow.org or give us a call, 206-543-KUOW, 206-543-5869. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
I mentioned mowers, leaf blowers, water. Let's start with lawn mowers, because I'm sure everybody living in our region heard them this weekend. And you might want to be totally ecologically correct and push a non-externally sourced lawnmower. But say you don't want to do that. There's electric lawnmowers, gas lawnmowers. Is there a way to mow and be ecologically correct?
The best is the one that works for you. And so the rechargeable electric one is the one that we've used. We have a tiny yard, and we've downsized our yard, turned it into ground cover.
Well, that's a whole, yes.
And edibles. We have a vegetable garden in our parking strip, but we still have a little bit of lawn. And the electric rechargeable ones are great. Much better than messing around with that gas and the smell and using a fossil fuel.
So electric rechargeable, like an electric car?
Well, there are several excellent types. The one we have is a Black & Decker. There's also a Toro one called the Recycler. They're $300 or $400, and you plug it in between sessions of mowing your lawn, and that recharges the battery.
Hmm.
So it is a bit like an electric car.
I suppose you mentioned pulling out lawns. We talked to our gardening panel on Tuesdays, and for years they've said, really, if you want to be totally environmentally correct, it's just rip it out and plant a xeriscape, a landscape that doesn't really even need any watering.
But that might not work for everybody, and it's a lot of work. And some people want a lawn, especially if you have kids or dogs.
Okay.
So you need to make all these choices work for you. And I believe for all the summer stuff, for going green, that the first priority should be safety. So with a lawnmower, getting away from the using gas and using other power equipment makes it more safe. Making sure your grill is safe. Making sure you use sunscreen, and then go for the greeny stuff.
Well, before I hop over to grills, I want to talk. I have another question about lawns. The other advice that we've always had from everybody over the summer when it is our drought season is don't water the lawn. It'll be fine. But will it really be fine?
It always comes back. We don't water our lawn, and it will. I guess it's possible if it was 100 degrees for 2 months in a row, it would fry so much it wouldn't come back. But I doubt that would happen. The grass comes back, so you can let it go brown if that works for you.
What about vegetable gardens or flower gardens? What's the best way to use to get the bang for your drip, I guess?
Trying to not have a lot of runoff and watering in the evening or the morning, not in the heat of the day where it's going to evaporate real quick. Those would be two simple tips.
Is there any evidence that a drip sprinkler system saves water over, those sort of fancy sprinklers that pop up and spritz the lawn?
I think so, absolutely. I don't know the exact stats, but yes, that would be a better way because it just eases it and doesn't use as much. So if you have it set up right, a drip system should be great.
We're talking with Tom Watson. He writes the Eco-Consumer column for the Seattle Times. And I didn't know we had an Eco-Consumer department at King County, but he is head of the public outreach program there. Jim joins us from Seattle, and our phone number 206-543-KUOW. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Thank you. I always wondered about the issue of grilling outdoors contributing to global warming with all the smoke and all. Is it possible that the fact of the matter is that it's sort of like I heard someone once say that if everybody in the world fix their leaky, dripping faucet, that the truth of that is that it really wouldn't even put a dent in the problems of water consumption. Is that sort of like the case with grilling, that if everyone stopped grilling, it really wouldn't be that big an impact? Or is it simply the fact that we just don't want to grill, and so we kind of give grilling a pass? It's a kind of a cultural blind spot as far as global warming is concern.
That's such an interesting question, Jen.
I don't think people need to stop grilling, but you need to make it work for you and try to figure out when you're going to grill or do the things for your household and your lifestyle the greenest ways, and consider climate change and reducing toxics and making those decisions. And so you can grill. I think a way to reduce the impact of grilling, a big one would be to grill a little less meat, because production of beef is such a huge global impact that going a little heavier on the veggies, not buying quite as much beef, that would be a way to do it, for example.
Well, that's interesting. And now we're talking about the food chain. Yeah, no kidding. Thanks for that question, Jim. Well, what about, I know that there are, at least in Pierce County, as I saw this on public television, they have people patrolling for the bad kind of inserts for fireplaces and wood-burning smoke. So when we're talking about grills, I mean, they do emit, is there a difference between a gas grill and a charcoal grill in terms of what it puts out into the environment?
I've had people complain about the grilling smoke from their neighbors, so you need to be considerate, of course. I think the propane grills that many of us have are fairly green. You can exchange the propane tanks for a new one, and you just want to really make sure that the grill is safe. One hazard that we've been talking about lately, these old-fashioned grill brushes that have the metal bristles.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
They'll come out, get stuck to the grate on the grill, and then people swallow them when it sticks to the meat. So get rid of that grill brush with metal bristles and use like a pumice stone or just old aluminum foil or something.
Huh. Oh, that's an interesting point. Tom Watson's with us, and we're talking about an eco summer, I suppose, how to have your tools and enjoy them too without too much guilt. We talked about water. We talked about grills. And so, again, just so I clarify, you aren't focusing, at least in your office, so much on the difference between the actual fire emission, the gas emissions with or without meat of the propane versus the charcoal?
No, not necessarily. There's different ways to reduce the impact for charcoal grilling and other kinds of grilling. So you want to pick the one that really works best for the kind of grilling that you want to do, and then reduce the impacts for that.
543-5869 is our phone number, or you can email us weekday@kuow.org, as Teresa did. She says, we really like to go downtown and to the surrounding areas of Seattle for all the summer festivals, but with many of the bus services being cut and none or limited service operating on weekends where we live, how are we able to enjoy the Seattle summer fun and still be environmentally friendly? How will the budget cuts at Seattle Metro impact Seattle's wish to be completely carbon neutral in the future?
There are a lot of trade-offs that politicians and public officials are wrestling with. If the money's not there, how do they provide the transit service? And I believe that there are still a lot of great transit options. People can also consider the car sharing, like the Car2Go cars. And there are so many options for biking, electric bikes, where to handle the longer distances. Ways to combine. Maybe you want to combine riding your bike to a bus stop if the bus service has changed and it's a little farther away, and put the bike on the bus. There's a lot of options now to figure it out, and it's getting a little better, but it still can be challenging. I sympathize. It's great that they want to reduce their transportation impacts in the summer.
I have a question about something that I buildings use, but houses we don't, as consumers, use them so much, but it's still air conditioners. It seems like, for the most part, I've always been told we don't need them here, and yet we see them increasingly. So if we decided we wanted an air conditioner, how do we use it in an environmentally friendly way? I don't even know if they're inherently environmentally awful.
No, I would not say that. And before, you mentioned green guilt, and I think that's really a big thing in Seattle. It's like, oh my gosh, if I got an air conditioner, I wouldn't be green enough, and I shouldn't have to have an air conditioner in Seattle, like you said. But if people in your household need to keep cool, and that's the only way to do it, mm-hmm. I think it's fine. We have a small room air conditioner at our house, my wife and I, and we don't. There was one year a couple years ago where it didn't get hot enough. We didn't even bring it upstairs and put it in. But often we do. And if your house gets so hot, you need to figure out a way to deal with it. Maybe you can do it with ventilation or ceiling fans. If you need an air conditioner, get an energy efficient one, an Energy Star rated one. Keep the filter cleaned out to make sure it's efficient. So there's ways to keep it greener.
Well, you mentioned ventilation. A lot of us have fans.
Yes.
And I always wondered how much electricity those fans, you know, the box fans that you put in your window, or just stand fans that a lot of us have. I know when it gets over 75 at our house, we like fans.
You have to have something in Seattle. It gets hot enough and the houses heat up. You need fans or an air conditioner or something. And I have heard that the box fans and most fans don't use tons of electricity, that's not really too bad. Of course, you want to minimize the use. A ceiling fan can really help, too.
Hmm. We're talking with Tom Watson. Joe from Mill Creek, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. I am a former Seattleite. I was born and raised in Seattle and left 30 years ago after high school. And I now live in southern New Mexico in the Chihuahuan Desert. And one thing I always joke about is that when I come to Seattle and Seattle doesn't get rain for 3 days, people start screaming drought. And, you know, being in the desert, I kind of know what a drought looks like. So I wonder, how is a drought defined up in this area?
Do you know the answer to that question? I thought that the summers were always considered periods of drought.
I would say that it's defined by a shortage of water, and so not raining for a long time and not having the reservoirs filled up from the melt off from the snowpack. But I don't know of any formal definition. That would be a better question for a weather expert. I think there might be varying definitions of that.
You know what, Joe? I'm going to put that question on Friday to Nick Bond, the Washington State climatologist who we speak to. So I'm writing a note, and I'm asking the producers to make a note as well.
That's a good one, Marcy.
Yes. But thank you for your call. We're also supposed to get a little rain perhaps this week, so maybe this isn't exactly the time when we think of drought. Mary writes in, I haven't heard the whole segment. The part I heard, you didn't discuss environmental impact of what is on the grill. We actually did meet Mary. So thanks for reminding us again about the fact that to produce a pound of meat is far more it requires a lot more of the planet than it does to produce a pound of wheat, for example.
And I want to put a pitch in for grilling veggies on the grill. If you grill veggies, if you have kids at your party or whatever, they might eat veggies then and they wouldn't eat veggies otherwise. You put them on skewers. I just talked to one of my bosses at work, and he's kind of a macho guy. He's a hunter, but he grills vegetables, including greens. He has a wok attachment. He has a certain kind of wok.
Really? On his grill?
On his grill. And I had not heard of that. I looked it up. You can buy these woks for the grill. So he grills greens and veggies on his grill in his wok, along with his, I'm sure, big slabs of meat.
Wow. I have to look up that one. I also have seen an ad for this sort of little portable gas thing that's not really a grill. So I don't know if it takes less energy or not. Let's switch from grilling to something that my neighbors also do continually, which is wash their cars. What is the best way for us, aside from having a dusty car, which is sort of another symbol of green pride in Seattle, how do we keep our car clean environmentally?
The general consensus among water quality folks and other environmental types is that it's best to take it to a car wash.
That's it. Just don't wash it yourself.
Well, even as long as you're sure, and I'm pretty sure that most of them handle their water well, you can do a self car wash, and I do that sometimes, where they will collect the runoff
at the actual at a self car wash facility. As
yes,
opposed to,
where you put in the coins or a credit card and do it yourself.
Doesn't matter if you use soap or not if you're at home, right? It's the runoff actually from your car that can impact the streams in our area.
Well, the runoff of all the oil and the dirt from the car, but the soap could too. So if you are going to do it, you might consider pulling it up under the grass and just letting it drain and not run down into the storm sewers, and use biodegradable soap.
Maggie says, I had people who hate eggplant coming back for seconds to my grilling by marinating and grilling the vegetables. That, Maggie, is a whole other segment. Maybe we need to have the summer grilling segment. I don't think Tom Absolutely. Watson, the eco-consumer, is necessarily supposed to be a culinary consumer advisor as well.
Well, I eat like everybody else. Everyone thinks they're experts on food because we all eat, right? But
yeah.
But you could bring some, one of the great foodie types or chefs, have them come in and talk about grilling veggies. Thanks for that comment about the eggplant. I want to go home and grill some eggplants. my wife does fantastic grilling of vegetables. You can, one way is to use aluminum foil and wrap it that way. And then when you have the burned used aluminum foil, you can use that to scrape your grill, kind of clean your grill.
It's just a last question. If there's like the number one culprit in terms of energy use or pollution of all these summer tools and things that we do, what would it be? What should we be most conscious of?
I think one of the folks mentioned driving, the amount that we drive in the summer, going on our trips and everything. I think that's probably the biggest environmental impact that most of us make is our driving.
Huh. And I don't assume that riding a plane would be less harsh on the environment.
Well, that is a big, let's say not just driving, but travel. So that would include the plane trips.
So stay home, grill vegetables, Stuart says, get a solar panel for your roof.
Now, see, I just hate to have it presented like that because I drive and take vacations and do these things, but you can think about the impact and ways of reducing it a little bit. I'm not at all saying not to do these things, but to try and just consider greener ways to do them if they work for you, because there are so many options now and so many choices.
Tom Watson manages King County's Eco-Consumer Public Outreach Program. He writes the Eco-Consumer column in the Seattle Times. And he's got a blog through the King County website, so you can find, he writes about everything from grilling to plastic water bottles and more. Thank you for coming in today.
Oh, it's really been fun.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
It's 9:35. Colin McCann's new book has been described as a profoundly moving novel that employs exquisite language to explore the limits of language and the tricks of memory. Colin McCann is here, and we're going to talk with him in a minute.
Hi, I'm Linda Wertheimer. Public radio takes you beyond the buzz of daily headlines and digs into issues that are important to you. KUOW and NPR are here for you every day, but only with your support. You may have received a special appeal in the mail. Please mail back your gift or make a gift online at KUOW.org. Thank you.
64 degrees in Seattle. It's partly cloudy. Forecast says partly sunny today with a chance of showers and a high of 72.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop service from Seattle to Dubai and on to 10 destinations in India. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:36. We'll turn our attention to the wind chimes of Magnolia in about 20 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. How does a novelist approach history? National Book Award-winning writer Colm McCann talks about the blurred spaces between fiction and nonfiction, the real that's imagined and the imagined that is real. In his newest book, Transatlantic, the pole star around which these blurred spaces revolve is Ireland. The novel recounts a collection of historical events from U.S. Senator George Mitchell's efforts to broker the Good Friday Peace Accords to a transatlantic flight from Canada to a field in Ireland. Colm McCann joins me in the studio. It's wonderful to have you here.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
I have to read a line from this book that just stuck with me because I think it describes you, not your character. This is actually a fictional character who's a journalist. Her name is Emily, and she's, I can't remember, the second or third generation in this group of women.
That's right, second generation.
Second.
Yeah.
She wanted her articles to have the compression and rhythm of poems. Mm-hmm. And reading your book, it's not really, someone asked me, well, what is it about? And I said, it's about the language and it's about the experiences and not, it's not a plot-driven mm-hmm. work. That is that your approach to writing?
Yeah, people ask me, you know, what is the book about? And my standard stock answer now is it's about 301 pages. Because, I mean, the thing about it is, to me, the great dignity of writing a novel and the great dignity of presenting anything, a piece of journalism, a play, a poem, is that you allow people to step inside it and make their own ideas about what it happens to be. And in that sense, I like it to have, as you say, the compression and the rhythm of poetry, but also that space in poetry where you're just allowed to walk in and interpret it.
The book begins with this transatlantic flight by two Englishmen from Canada back to Ireland. This is a true episode in history, 1919, something I'd never heard of these two men. Is this something everybody knows about but me?
No. I didn't even know about it. I always thought that the first transatlantic flight was done by Lindbergh.
Me too.
But that was the first solo transatlantic flight. But unbelievably, 8 years beforehand, these two guys who stepped out of the out of World War One, and all that dying that they'd seen, you know, in the fields of Europe, they decide to take the bomb bays from an old Vickers Vimy bomber, replace it with petrol tanks, and try to win £10,000 by flying across the ocean, and they do it.
Well, they do it, but I mean, this is a plane. It's kind of like if you've ever seen the, I think it's a Fred Astaire movie, Flying Down to Rio, which is about trick planes with people standing right on the wings. It's that kind of an airplane.
It is.
It's open.
Yeah.
It's cold. They're wearing, at least according to you, I don't know what they really wore, but I felt, you know, they're on this plane in the snow, in the clouds, freezing to death.
Yeah, well, they were. The tip ends of their hair froze underneath their helmets, and actually, the book is sort of forensically correct on the details. There is this idea on the internet that Alcock and Brown went across, and at one stage, Brown stepped out of the cockpit and went wing walking as some sort of like form of joy as he's going over. No way, they were terrified. They were in the snow. They were between layers of cloud. They didn't have a gyroscope, and they basically went by the seat of their pants and ended up ditching in a bog in Galway. And very few people actually know about it, but it was fun to write about.
Well, that starts this book. But is that where you started with the writing?
No. I was initially corralled by what I think is another fantastic story, which is that Frederick Douglass, the great American abolitionist, slave, whatever you want to call him, author, orator, this magnificent man, at the early age of 27, was still a slave, went over, was going to England, actually, to do a series of lectures about abolition. But they gave him a rehearsal, a trial run in Ireland for 4 months. And lo and behold, I mean, he changed. He embraced the world in a brand new way because he saw a country shattered down by famine and poverty. And he says at one stage, he said, I am here under the emerald skies, and lo, the chattel becomes a man.
Hmm.
And he wasn't called the N-word when he was over there. And all these extraordinary things happened to him. And yet he had to embrace contradiction in so many ways.
So you started with his story.
Yeah, he broke me too. he really broke me. It was so hard to write about. I spent well over a year trying to capture him. The problem being that he has his own beautiful voice, and he'd written a narrative of the life of a slave, and had written subsequently, and his speeches were beautiful, so I couldn't put it in any first person, and I needed to have like a distance from him, and yet get really close to him. And one of the things that happened to me was, one of the very simple things that happened to me was, I went to his house in Washington, D.C., which is now a museum, and I noticed that on the floor of his bedroom, he had barbells. And this blew my mind. And it said so much about him that, you know, his relationship to his body, his relationship to himself, but these iron barbells. And I don't know whether he had them in Ireland or not, but I gave them to him.
I was going to say, he does in your book.
And he's melted them down from slave chains as a metaphor. But I think even if it's untrue, it's deeply true. And that's where I like to negotiate these ideas, that it has to be texturally true. And there's a difference between honesty and fact. And we all know that facts can be manipulated. But if you get something and you try to be as honest as possible, then perhaps you can capture the soul of someone.
The third real character is, as I mentioned in introducing you, Senator George Mitchell, who was tapped by President Clinton to go to Belfast over a course of years to try to hammer out the peace that President Obama referred to this morning.
Right.
Unlike Frederick Douglass or these two aviators, George Mitchell lives in the city where you live, I believe, New York.
Yeah. Senator Mitchell is actually 10 blocks from my house. So I was kind of terrified to write about him, but I got in touch with him and his wife first, and they very generously allowed me the space to go in as a fiction writer, which must be completely terrifying, because, you know, like, if a journalist goes in, she or he has to at least cleave to some notion of the facts.
Mm.
Although we also know that can be fictional as well and can be skewed. But I have Mitchell on the opening page of the section where he's 64 years old and he has a 5-month-old son, which is all true. And in the place where he lives in New York, changing a nappy.
A diaper.
And you know, the thing is, in journalism, we generally don't change nappies, nor do we do so in certainly history doesn't. You know, we don't think of, say, you know, President Obama getting up this morning to brush his teeth, you know, as he did at the G8.
He must have done.
I hope so. I'm sure he did.
We're going to talk about Obama in just a second, but one of the things that you just threw out there, journalism, you actually started out on this writing career as a journalist. Yeah. I don't know how long-lived that career was.
It's still going. I mean, I don't see any difference whatsoever between the poet or the journalist, between the playwright and the fiction writer. I think that the word is the good word put down in the right place at the right time says something about the human condition. So I don't privilege the idea of fiction over journalism or vice versa. I think that all of these things amount to good storytelling. That tends to shock journalists, and they think I'm playing to them, but I'm not playing to them. I come from a family of journalists. My dad was a journalist. I began as a journalist.
Right. You were actually writing, I think, a pop culture column at the beginning.
Yeah. Somehow that like crawled into my Wikipedia entry, which,
yes,
this is another thing. Wikipedia. All right. It's a complete and utter fiction. Like, people take it as gospel. And like, there was some university on there that said, I work for Hunter College in New York.
Right.
Another university.
That's true, right?
That is true.
Okay.
But there's, it's crept on there that like, I'm a full-time professor for a European university, which I've visited twice, but I'm not a full-time. So we have to doubt what is presented to us. And I think this is the job now of the poet, of the fiction writer, to incubate a certain amount of doubt about what we're told officially, and so that we can educate ourselves as to what's really going on.
Well, I suppose it was fortuitous for me that this morning I woke up after finishing your book, thinking about the fact that you do come from Ireland. You're born, and people can't tell, you're born in Dublin and came here as a late teen, early 20s.
Yeah, early 20s, yeah.
But this morning, there was President Obama there for the G8 summit giving a speech that touched directly on the George Mitchell section of your book, and not just that, but touching on you, and if you want to hold those headphones up to your ears, we're going to play a clip of this is President Obama speaking in Belfast this morning.
Peace is indeed harder than war, the Irish author Colin McCann recently wrote. And its constant fragility is part of its beauty. A bullet need happen only once. But for peace to work, we need to be reminded of its existence again and again and again.
That's President Obama speaking in Belfast this morning. That's from this book.
I haven't heard that. It gives me the absolute shivers to hear that. And you know, I'm delighted that he's talking. He's talking there to a group of young people.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is that, yeah, a bullet need only happen once. But for us to continue our peace and this sort of revelation of decency, which actually started under Clinton and continued under Mitchell, and Obama there is talking and saying that it is important for us to know that it's harder to wage peace than it is to wage war. And I think, that's an essential thing. And we can't be, we can't say it enough. What has happened in Ireland, what happened at the end of the last century, is a fantastic thing for us to have happened to us. It's difficult. And you got to keep doing it again. And there would be Molotov cocktails that would be thrown this month, mm-hmm. maybe even at the G8 summit, who knows. But the fact of the matter is that the people who lead us or represent us, rather, which is a better way of putting it, have to keep saying these things.
Your mother's from Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
This book is in addition to this sort of poetic evocations of these three men, there's a whole group of women that come from a line starting with Lily Duggan or Dugan?
Duggan, yeah.
Duggan.
Yeah.
Her line, these are fictional women, but their story actually weaves in more with Senator Mitchell's work, I think. And so the whole notion of Ireland and poverty versus wealth and mm-hmm. Catholics versus Protestants, the troubles, all of that does underlie the stories of these individual people.
Right. Well, I wanted it to be truly transatlantic. And to be truly transatlantic, the whole thing is that there is an ocean between us, but that's a tapestry. And if you weave that tapestry properly, we understand that these small moments, like, you know, that you and I and our the listeners out there do every single day, they actually weave into the grand fabric of politics, of time, of history. We don't acknowledge that all the time. But the small, the anonymous moment is really important.
Colin McCann's our guest. His new book is called Transatlantic. You have been in this country. You came, as I mentioned, more than 20 years ago, I think.
Yeah, almost 30 years
almost
ago.
Almost 30 years ago. And I don't think you intended to stay here, did you?
No, I just came across. I was on a lark, really, and tried to write a novel, failed miserably, and then took a bicycle across the United States, which was like an incredible journey, starting on the East Coast and finished in San Francisco about a year and a half later, and a sort of different person at the end of it all.
And was it a conscious decision then that I'm just going to stay in the States?
No. I mean, these things happen. You just end up falling in love and met a girl from New York, and we're still married. And so I went back down to Texas. I worked down in Texas. Then we went off to Japan for a while, went back to Ireland, and then moved to New York. But these things are sort of, you know, a lot of writers, especially Irish writers in the early part of the century, they went because they needed to go. There was some form of oppression, whether it be the church, whether it be economics, whether it be, you know, just Irish values that were pressing down upon them. I left because I was curious and I wanted to actually be a beat writer. I wanted to be Kerouac or Ginsberg or Ferlinghetti, but I didn't have the right hair.
This is not really a beat novel, Transatlantic, and neither was your last novel.
No. Well, the thing is, I was influenced by the beats, but you get your voice from the voices of others and you build it up and hopefully you develop your own style then.
I saw a picture of you in the New York Times writing in essentially a cupboard. Is that true?
It's true. I've been outed now. I write in the closet.
with a little piece of wood as a lap desk.
Yeah, yeah. I had this cupboard that was there, and I was having a friend build a desk, and he's a great carpenter. I said, listen, man, why don't we just extend the desk right into the cupboard there? I don't know why I was doing it, but, you know, good place for the dog to lie or something like that, because it's a tiny little cupboard. So I crawled up onto the desk and sat in there, and it actually felt very comfortable. So I put a cushion underneath me, and, you have to be careful because, like, you got to get up and stretch every couple of hours or else you're in serious trouble.
Yeah, we don't want your legs to go to sleep permanently. Right. So that's kind of an isolation chamber. You're far from your native land as well. And I wonder, reading this, whether you could have written this particular book living in Dublin.
No. And I am aware that, like, part of what I have luckily experienced is the ability to be away, and then now to go back to have some sort of idea about what it is, some sort of distance, the privileged viewpoint of the observer, to stand outside and just be able to look in. I realize that. I doubt that I could have done it if I'd been at home.
Both Frederick Douglass and George Mitchell in this book are outsiders on the other side of the Atlantic. Does that sense of being there but apart come from the fact that you are there but apart in New York? I mean, you're a New Yorker, but you're not a New Yorker.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that hits the nail on the head. For me, you know, I don't really want to write about myself. I mean, I live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, blah, blah, blah. I got three kids and life is fairly comfortable. But going back in the guise or somewhat in the skin of Frederick Douglass was a huge thrill. To go back in the skin of those aviators was also a huge thrill. And then George Mitchell, of course. But then to come out again in the body and the bodies, quote unquote, of these women. So they move while people are coming from America to Ireland, they're moving from Ireland to America. So in many ways, I mean, I don't want to sit on the, I don't want to put myself on the psychoanalyst's couch, but so much of this novel is really autobiographical. But I haven't examined it yet. And I sort of pushed that sort of interpretation away.
Did you have to be at a certain point in your life to write about Ireland?
Yes. Yes, you know, I've been writing about lots of other things. Let the Great World Spin was about New York in 1974. Then I did a novel about gypsies in Eastern Europe, and I did a novel about the homeless people in the subway tunnels.
And Nureyev.
Yes, I almost forgot about Nureyev. But and for me, that was great because I like being other and I like going out. And I think I was writing Irish novels, even though they never even mentioned Ireland. But for me, I knew it was on my conscience that at a certain stage, it's going to be time to go home and take it on in a certain way.
So this really is the first revisiting.
I did one, but it's a small book called Everything in This Country Must, which is specifically about Northern Ireland and very, very local.
The G8 summit, as we mentioned earlier, is in meeting in Northern Ireland. Mm. Starting today, and they're not really focusing on Northern Ireland. They're focusing on Syria. I think the president wanted to use that as a jumping off point. But it got me to thinking about the foundation that you have, Narrative 4, which is about peacemaking on a much more personal level. And
yes.
How does it's essentially matching people up? They tell their stories to one another, and then those people switch roles and they tell the other's story back to the group. How does a foundation like that play into George Mitchell's efforts to broker peace or President Obama's work with Syria?
I think that's a fantastic idea in the sense that the local becomes the universal. And all of the time that we tell stories, these walls are broken down. And, you know, here in Seattle, we've been helped out by the Bezos Family Foundation, who actually see the fact that these stories are, like, inherently democratic. So they've begun to support Narrative 4, which is a brand new organization mostly aimed at young people. And we want to get kids coming from Syria and coming from Belfast and coming from Copenhagen, coming from New Orleans, from Chicago, from Seattle, wherever it happens to be, mostly 15 and 16-year-olds. And they don't just tell their story. They get somebody else to tell it. They exchange stories. So they stand in someone else's shoes, which is the most privileged position to be.
Well, it just got me thinking about how you want to elevate the power of storytelling beyond the pages of a book or, yes, or a newspaper or a magazine.
You think about somebody like Dave Eggers, what Dave Eggers has been doing, not only writing beautiful books, but being at the edge of social movement and saying this stuff matters. Your life matters. Your story matters. Roddy Doyle in Ireland, he does it too. He has an organization called Fighting Words, and it gets young people together and they open the door and they go in and they sit down and they write. And I think it's a good thing, and we're all working together, hopefully, to, you know, because there's a lot of difficult stuff that we've got to stand up against. We all know, just open the papers, look at Turkey, you know, look at Syria, and we can't say, you know, we're going to solve the world, but you can become a very small stay against all that despair.
And then who knows, someday a political figure will use your words. You weren't the only one. The president, Obama, used peace comes dropping slow. He quoted Yeats.
W.B. Yeats,
National Book Award winning writer Colm McCann. It's been a pleasure having you in here.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Colm McCann's new novel is called Transatlantic, and he's going to be speaking tonight at 7:30 at Town Hall, Seattle. This is Weekday. The sound of the day. It's pretty. It's the sound of wind chimes on listener Kathy's front deck in Magnolia. They get quite the battering from the wind coming off Puget Sound.
I thought we were entering the land of make-believe.
I like that. It's kind of like Colin McCann's words. They're beautiful like that. Kathy says she's had pedestrians walk up onto her front porch to find the beautiful noise. Her husband has repaired these chimes numerous times after finding parts blown into her wisteria. And with his care and his talent, these chimes play once again. That's lovely. Thanks, Kathy. What interesting sounds are you listening to? Record 30 seconds of what you hear and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email the audio file to weekday@kuow.org. Include sound of the day in your subject line. The sound of the next hour might be hairspray. We're going to be talking with David Armstrong. Also going to hear a little bit about what's happening at the Paris Air Show, Bernard. So you stay with us as well.
I'll be here. By the way, those chimes might be getting some action today. Light winds are in the forecast for the Seattle area, as are partly sunny skies, a chance of showers, and a high of 72. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Regents Blue Shield, helping members understand the effects of the Affordable Care Act at healthcareandreform.com. Regents Blue Shield serves select counties in Washington and is an independent licensee of the BCBSA.
Let's talk about employee rights for a moment. Do you think it's illegal to fire someone for having freckles? Well, think again. So what are your rights as an employee in Washington State? We're taking that up later today, and you can help us.